Welcome everybody. We've been working, you know, quite a bit on putting this together. When I joined the foundation something like 1.5 years ago, I was probably one of the persons that was involved in many initiatives already in open data in my country, Spain, doing something like 6-7 initiatives for different levels of government, and seeing how open data started to be used in my country. And I was identifying, you know, a number of issues coming up. Not only there, but also in initiatives like in the UK, in the US, and others. One of the things that I learned also when I joined the foundation is that the global south is very, very different. I saw some people trying to do some sort of transplant of initiatives from the Western world to the global south, and that not working very well. And I started to be quite concerned about that. We started to discuss a little bit with IDRC how we could, you know, get an idea on whether or not open data should be done in the global south and how it should be done. How the importance of context there could be something that should be put at the forefront of any single open data quarter. And how we could measure what we call the emerging impact in this project, as you know. So I'm so glad that finally we are having this meeting here to discuss about that. And we will be discussing, you know, some of our ideas that we intend to put forward in bring the project. We would love to hear your comments and suggestions about that.
Thank you so much. So again, this panel is taking place this morning as part of this broader research initiative on open data. And Tim, if you could tell us a bit more about it.
I'll try and take very briefly through some of the journey so far. Some of the people in this room have been joining us on that summit, your first encounter. So that journey so far started with, as has been said, this recognition that there are open data initiatives cropping up across the world, both government-led initiatives of those 30 or so that Felipe mentioned, but also many civil society-led initiatives. And through this programme, already we've discovered all sorts of open data action using data for governance that's not necessarily conceived of as an open government data initiative, but that's got a lot to teach us. So with that recognition that this was an emerging area, a number of the people who are here met in Brasilia alongside the first open government partnership meeting and started mapping out what's being said about open data, what are the potential impacts that are being claimed. And we see many, many potential impacts of open data, whether it's transparency and accountability, economic growth, improving policy, improving environmental sustainability, a whole range of areas where people are seeing potential, yet we've also got very big gaps in our knowledge in actually understanding what are the feedback mechanisms that lead from data to policy change, who are the beneficiaries and how are the benefits of open data distributed. Is there a trickle-down benefit or is it accumulated, perhaps empowering the already empowered? How does open data interact with existing policy agendas around right to information? So we came up with this whole set of areas where we had gaps in our knowledge, and we ended that a day-long workshop with a sense of some of the research areas and challenges that we need to explore. And what we've then done since that workshop is try to develop a bit of a framework to think about how we can study emerging impacts of open data in the south, and the first iteration of that had these three parts to it, saying there are many kinds of open data. There's data from and about governments, the classic open government data. There's also data about companies and markets, perhaps under targeted transparency type things where governments say companies must release data or companies proactively choose to release data. And then there's data about citizens, both in aggregate statistics that governments and other institutions collect, and perhaps clouding open data a bit, some of the smart disclosure or my data work where people have got direct access to their own data. We've then got different domains of governance, political, economic and social domains into which that data feeds and fits, each with their own dynamics. And then we've got this range of different emerging outcomes from transparency and accountability, innovation and economic growth, and inclusion and empowerment, and could be many more categories, but those were the ones we tried to work with to say we want to look and find case studies that can illuminate how is open data having emerging impacts in each of these spaces. So around June time, I think, late June, at the World Bank's International Open Government Data Conference, we launched a call for proposals, asking projects in the South to propose case study research, quite localized case study research, into how data was being used in practice in governance settings. So a real shift from what's happening on the supply side to what's happening on that news side as well. And we were expecting maybe 20 or so. We got 83 different proposals from 30 different countries. That's just a quick heat map of those. And all those proposals are here in this box. Our panel who are staying after lunch are going to have to get that down to 15 or so that will be shortlisted for funding and resourcing. But this fits into this broader open data research network. So the emerging impacts of open data in the South is a focused, funded piece of work we're hoping to take forward. But we also recognise that it's got to link up with a whole range of other open data research going on, and that's where I think we then start our workshop of saying, what are these key perspectives for open data research, both in the Global South, but also more broadly, that we need to be connecting with, and our goal by lunchtime is to have made all the connections we need. Got to really
check the front. Thanks a lot, Tim. Okay, so back to the panel. Now we're running short on time.
Already?
Despite all our efforts. Yeah. And we have until 10:30, which leaves us about an hour for the panel. We'll spend about 30 minutes or so with the members of the panel. We'll have two presenters and two discussants, and that will leave us about other 30 minutes for the floor and comments and questions. Again, this panel is titled Open Data Impact, Identifying Key Perspectives in Open Data Research. The big aim of the panel is about highlighting which of the dynamics within the supply side and the demand side of open data that matter for potential outcomes and potential impact. So I would just like to introduce Susan, who will be the queen of this panel, and she is in charge not only to help us stick on time, but also get the best of your comments and questions for the last 30 minutes. So, Susan.
Okay, terrific. So, as our pulses are racing with the interest and excitement of this session, which it really is dramatic, that we've now heard what's happened so to date, and now we're going to get a set of critical perspectives, a way of looking, a set of frameworks that'll help the people working on these proposals to clump them together, to question them, to have a really acute sensibility as they approach them. I've asked my beloved colleague Archon Fung to speak first. He's a professor at the Kennedy School who's written and thought deeply about civic participation and democracy as a subject, which is a pretty big subject, and also not as well known to me, but also well liked, David Eves, who is a Canadian guru, we like to call him, of open data. And who recently visited my class where the students were so enthusiastic they're still talking about it. So we'll begin with Archon for about 10 minutes, and I will nudge you when we get close. And then David, and then Yochai and I will respond. I'll introduce us after that. Go ahead, Archon.
Great. Thanks a lot. Thanks, everyone, and especially to the organizers, Felipe and others, for inviting me. I'll speak quickly because I want to present some provocative kind of questions and frameworks for you. I spent a lot of years at MIT as a graduate student and undergraduate, and one of the things we used to say there is science is not neutral. And this was addressed to a bunch of people who thought, well, you know, the production of knowledge and engineering, it's good no matter what, and so we're just going to do it, and then pretty soon you have, you know, undergraduates and professors working on fuel air explosives and chemical weapons and in an earlier stage cluster bombs. And I just want to really make sure that the open data movement doesn't go that way. Right? We think openness is great, right? But I want to say data are not neutral, and present some comments to get you to think about how exactly it's not neutral. The first question is the scope of data, and data about whom, right? And this goes to Tim's figure about who's disclosing data. Is it citizens? Is it government? Is it corporation? Or is it corporations? And that question is always answered by the demand side and the politics of who's demanding data. Now, we usually think of demand as the users of data, right? And we'll talk a lot about that. I'll talk about that in a moment. A lot of people will talk about who's using data as the demand side. But there's another demand side. There's a political demand for who is demanding what kinds of data, right? And one... The open government movement was produced in part by some people in this room who are constitute part of the political demand for more data from government, or at least data that government holds. And so I think it's important to think about that demand side and what you and other people are asking for, what kinds of data you're demanding and asking for, as one dimension, one important and overlooked dimension of demand. Okay, so what data should we demand? So far, I think, of those categories of who's being made transparent, 90% of the data are data about government. And that's what we call the open government movement. I like to call it the naked government movement as a polemical move, right? Naked government has three principles, right? Open data publicity, not secrecy is the default. Information is provided digitally. And that the focus is largely on the government and not the private sector. Now, one question put, in, again, in a highly polemical way, is open government the cluster bomb of our time? Naked government, right? And so the question here is, does naked government make people cynical about the state? Which would be very ironic, because the state is the only apparatus with the power and authority large enough to get us the data in the first place. So if the very data that we're demanding undermine the legitimacy and authority of that institution that can provide the data, then open government kind of spirals in a self-destructive way, right? I think that I don't know whether open government or naked government makes people cynical about government. I think that there are good reasons to think that it might, right? So transparency as is right now mostly information for accountability. Right? It's not information to register when government is doing a good job. It's mostly information to register when government is doing a bad job. This data flows into many publics in the developing world and certainly in the United States that are already cynical about government, and a journalistic environment that sells stories by catching government doing something wrong. Right? You can't sell a newspaper by saying government did something good. That dog doesn't bite, as they say. So the news, what counts as news, is news about state failure. And so open government feeds, potentially, this cycle of delegitimation of government. So that's one way in which I think many progressives, including the Obama administration, are making a mistake by treating the open government movement as data about government for accountability. I think it just works at purposes cross to the purposes of a political view in which government is capable and can do some good stuff. I think it feeds the cynicism that is already a big problem. Okay, so that's the downside. Another dimension of this is that there is a mismatch, right? In an ideal society of information, the information that people would have would be proportionate to the risks that they face, okay? Now, if you're living in an authoritarian society, I think probably most of the risks to you do come from the state. In a capitalist democracy, I think a large part of the risks that most citizens face come from private entities, from corporations. And yet, there is a mismatch in our expectations, right? The threat to citizens, I think, from the government, at least in capitalist democracies, is pretty low on a bunch of issues that people care about, but the expectation on government to be transparent is very, very high. Conversely, a lot of threats to citizens, like the mortgage meltdown, or whether your spinach is infested with E. coli, or whether your car crashes because the brakes don't stop, is relatively high. Corporations create a lot of risk to citizens in a lot of different respects, and yet the transparency expectation on those entities is fairly low. So there's a mismatch, right? The political demand is mismatch. Okay. Okay, so I just draw a bar under that point, and I'll move to a second point here, a second question, is when does transparency have consequences? And this is, I take it, the point of the call for proposals that you guys did, the call for to look at the impacts of different kinds of open data efforts, okay? Now, it wasn't so long ago, I think, that people had an implicit presumption that data, once it was open, would almost always produce some kind of salutary impact, or at least anyway, that was the motive, right? That you'd get transparency. If you could only get transparency and openness, you'd get accountability or improved services or whatever it is. I think now many people are beginning to question that. automatic connection, and I think that's very good because the automatic connection is incorrect. One way to think about it in the area of at least development, developing countries and transparency, and even developed countries and transparency, where that transparency is meant to produce accountability, is that there, you can think of an accountability funnel, right? So there's a lot of data sets that open government and open data makes transparent. Some subset of those data sets actually spur or manage to engage people in participation. Many of those data sets nobody cares about, nobody ever uses, right? So that's why that second circle is smaller than the first circle. Only a few of them actually manage to interest people. And fewer still, I think sometimes a minuscule subset, actually result in some concrete impact like accountability. So I think there's a funnel here. And the interesting research question is, what is the shape of that funnel? How sharp is that gradient? I think that gradient is very, very, very sharp, right? And then what are the factors that explain the drop-off? Why is it that only a fraction of all the data sets that are out there manage to engage people, and only a small fraction of those result in some desired impact on the organizations that are becoming transparent? Right? I think that is probably the critical, or certainly a critical research question in this field. 2 minutes. Okay, great. We have a framework for thinking about that a little bit that we presented in full disclosure, and I won't go through the whole thing. But the idea is that information, in order to have impact, has to flow through what we call an action cycle. It has to be information that is salient to people's values, that's accessible to them, that actually results in, actually informs a choice that they actually have, and that the users, the actions of the users, redound on the large organizations whose behavior is being meant to be changed by open data in a salutary way. Anybody who's heard me talk, I always talk about the LA restaurant report card example, which is a very simple transparency effort that's very, very effective. Every restaurant in LA has to post a letter grade on its front door, A, B, or C, that is the reflection of its health and safety inspection, most recent health and safety inspection. This is a very elegant, very effective transparency system. It's interesting to think about why this one works when so many others go bust. Okay, so last question is, who uses the data? I think one, again, it wasn't so long ago that most people in thinking about this kind of had this implicit assumption that the main users of the data were ordinary individuals at the end of the day. I think for a lot of kinds of open data, that's just not the case, right? Even President Obama, when he was unveiling the recovery, reinvestment and recovery transparency system, recovery.gov, sketched this picture in which there would be millions of armchair analysts looking at the recovery.gov. That's ridiculous, right? To imagine that Joe Sixpack is going to come home from work and then boot up Stata on his computer and download a 100 megabyte data set and crank through it is just like not plausible. He's going to have a beer instead, right? And indeed, that turned out to be the case. People who are going to recovery.gov, ordinary people, most of them went because they were looking for a job. Right? But that's not the purpose of the site. The site isn't supposed to help you get a job. So it's interesting to think about who the most likely users of different kinds of open data sets are. And this is a hypothesis here. The hypothesis is that when you're making something about private data, private goods transparent, like restaurant consumption, then you have a shot at an individuals being the prime users of that data. But when the transparency system, when the data sets are meant to affect some public goods like accountability, corruption, or externalities, the chances of engaging ordinary individuals in the use of that data are minuscule. To the extent that individuals are, to the extent that there are users of those data, they are advocacy groups, media, our organizations, and so on, and you should design the data sets and the access of those data sets and the policy around those data accordingly. Don't expect ordinary individuals to be the prime users of those data. They won't be. Expect professional organizations to be the main users of those data. Here endeth the lesson. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a privilege to have David Eves here, who's a negotiation expert as well as an open data advisor to governance. So, David, your critical perspectives on the research agenda.
Yeah. So, I was asked to kind of, well, there's two things. One is, I have no business being on this panel. It's a gentleman. It makes me nervous to even be here sitting next to them since, definitely so since I took a red eye from San Francisco where I was emceeing the Code for America Summit and foolishly agreed to let Aaron Roeder back, who's the founder of Statement, to take me out for a cigar or two glasses of wine before getting on my plane. It's a more fragile state than I might normally be. But I was also going to look at the supply side of open data and, kind of, and what it might mean. And so what I wanted to kind of do is imagine a world where kind of open data has won. So, you know, like, everybody agrees that they should be doing it, it's out there, everybody has open data portals. And I think we've already begun to see some of the nice things that can start to happen around this. So some of the efforts around smart disclosure, which Arkan talked about, so things like restaurant inspection results, I'd love to see them not just on the front doors of restaurants, but also embedded into Yelp, into Google Maps, and to Urban Spoon. Because we, you know, as Arkan has chronicled, we know that when people see this data before they make a decision, they're much more likely to go to restaurants that have better results, and that actually has a big impact on healthcare costs, to say nothing of probably productivity. And we have also already seen kind of the use of data by organizations, especially, particularly in the private sector, in ways that I think are generally quite positive, the use of census data to figure out how to, like, you know, more efficiently place stores, and kind of, like, I think, enhance and make the economy more productive. In fact, when I was a tiny, tiny, tiny kid, when I was in elementary school, my best friend's father used to take the Canadian census data and digitize it and integrate it into maps and then sell that to companies so that they could figure out where they should put in their stores. So I remember hearing, like, you know, no McDonald's was placed in Canada until the census data had been looked at to figure out, you know, where they could target it. And you think back 30 years ago, the companies that had access to that type of information were only the very wealthiest. Whereas today, the people who can access census data, it's a much, much broader group of people. And so NGOs now are more likely to use census data than they would have been 30 years ago, and it would have been prohibitively expensive for them to do so. So I think that is kind of a place that is, you know, we have started moving in a good direction. And then finally, when you look at actually the most downloaded data sets on data.gc.ca, one of them is the Woodland Caribou roaming ranges, which actually is very close to my heart because I worked as the negotiation advisor to the Environmental Group Caucus. This is 12 environmental groups that negotiated with FPAC, which is the Forest Products Association of Canada, over how to manage the boreal forest. Because they were so tired of governments pitting them against each other, they said, why don't we just get into a room and see if the environmentalists in the industry can figure out how we should be doing this. And woodland caribou turns out to be the marker species by which you assess whether or not you've overlogged an area of boreal forest. And so that actually, that data set serves as a really core and important basis for a negotiation that I think has done a great deal to advance the interest of preserving the boreal forest in Canada and has actually global significance. So I think those are kind of some early indications of things that have gone right. But here's the danger, and I actually first talked about this 3 or 4 years ago, which is that I think there's a group of people out there that Arkan is worried about as well, of kind of data utopians who believe that kind of once we get all the data and once we have it all out there, the big algorithm in the sky is going to allow us to figure out how we can most perfectly manage our society. And because we'll all have the exact same data to look from, the decisions will all become easy because as rational actors, we'll all obviously agree on what the right outcome should be as a result. And so, like, there'll be no more politics because the answers to all of our problems will be very, very obvious. And I think that would be a horrible, horrible, horrible mistake to make. Governments have always, and private organizations always, have always treated data as an enormously political piece of kind of infrastructure or commodity or asset. When we kind of look around, going back in time, you kind of look at around the history of data, even something as simple as the US census data, I mean, there's huge battles in this country about whether or not you have to go physically count somebody or whether you can use a model to more accurately generate a view of how many people live in a given city or in a given neighborhood or in a given state. And this has real implications because it has implications around what the size of a Congress, what a riding is for an electoral area. And $400 billion in US federal money gets allocated depending on population rates. And so when you don't count all the people in your particular area,
That has real implications for how much money you get from the federal government. And it turns out that two censuses ago, it's roughly estimated that about 8 million African American and minority Americans and urban living Americans were simply not counted because they couldn't actually go and physically get them. And it turns out that out of 4 million largely white suburban Americans are actually double counted. So this is a great example of what I think is a very political data set. And the battle over how it gets collected is one that's actually it's fiercely fought in Congress. In fact, it's so fierce it actually can end up going to the Supreme Court. And that's just not the only example. You think of things like local crime data. I mean, I've talked a little bit about there's in Chicago, outside of Chicago in Illinois, there's this real look at like crime data and who's getting arrested, who's not getting arrested. Obviously, African Americans getting disproportionately arrested. But the piece of data you don't get is actually the most common reason for arrest is jaywalking. And then the additional piece of data you don't get is that they're actually often living in communities that don't have sidewalks. So it's very easy to arrest people when there's no sidewalk for them to be walking on for jaywalking. And of course, that local context gets lost. And even something even more simple than that, I was just talking yesterday actually to Eric, he was complaining about all the fire trucks that go around. So the numbers of fires that have occurred in most major cities in North America have been in sharp decline as sprinkler standards have been installed. But of course, the debate around how much we should pay firemen has not gone away, and firemen keep finding new ways for them to become useful. And one of the core data sets that firemen like to use to talk about how useful they are is how many sorties they make. So you'll notice now that firemen actually make way more sorties for car accidents, for medical emergencies, all sorts of things that you probably actually don't need the fireman to be there for. There's probably much cheaper ways to deliver that service, but because what we measure is how many sorties they make, that becomes the focus of the conversation, and of course they are very incented to make as many sorties as they possibly can. And then when I think about the Global South, I was actually thinking of you, because Chile recently, their government was kind of, if you will, quote unquote, busted suddenly producing a census that undercounted people, because now it makes it look like the GDP per capita is a whole lot better, and have also been tinkering with the notion of what the unemployment rate is to show that they've actually been achieving their objectives. And they're not the only ones. I mean, Argentina is, I think, actually the kind of the case point of the moment of a government that's literally going in and not just kind of tinkering with the data in a kind of a political sense, but actually just going in and actually rewriting the data so that it fits a political narrative that they have. In fact, it's such an extreme case. I had a friend who works for the World Bank who tried to tweet at one point. He said, I wonder how real that data from Argentina is. And he actually got an immediate call from the World Bank saying he had to delete that tweet because if someone from the World Bank says that Argentina is making up their data, actually has very real implications for whether or not they're allowed to secure further loans from the IMF and from the World Bank. So no official figure is allowed to do that. No official person is allowed to do that. But there is it shows you everybody knows that it's going on, but people actually are very reluctant to talk about it because it has bigger implications. And even sadly, my own country in Canada, data has become enormously political because our government didn't cancel the long-form census, which is the kind of longer form of the census that one in every six people get, but they made it voluntary, which was functionally destroying it. And the main reason I believe that they did this, since they actually spent more money to do it than to actually run it in a normal sense, is that they actually wanted to eliminate the collection of this data. Because if you simply don't collect the data, then you don't have to know that there's a problem, which means you don't actually have to build a social policy to fix it. So one of the big things I kind of think that open data is making us realize is as it becomes more open and as we gain more access to it, it's forcing us to realize that data is not just political today, but data has always been political. And that what's not going to happen is the big algorithm in the sky and the world of perfect, the world of kind of perfect debate where we're suddenly going to agree on everything. What's going to happen is the conversation is going to get pushed down the stack. And we're going to have politicians fighting over what type of data they should be collecting because they know it's going to end up in the hands of the public, regardless of whether it's open now or not, because of FOIA. And so they're going to get very controlling and very concerned about what's going to happen there. One more thing I want to say. The last part I wanted to make is I'm reading, if you haven't read Seeing Like the State, I cannot recommend this book enough. You should definitely go pick up Seeing Like the State. And I think there's actually a Seeing Like the State versus Seeing the State debate that I think open data is going to generate. That when you look at why the state first started to generate data, it was, of course, to try to control citizenry. We all have last names because you are all, frankly, data points that the state wanted to track, and only tracking you by first names was too difficult. So the state actually forced us all to create last names so we would all be much more trackable so it could figure out how to tax us. The same with cadastral maps, like all these things, but also the state could manage its assets more effectively. What I think is interesting is when we start doing more open data, especially if we're able to standardize that data across across jurisdictions, the question we have to ask ourselves is, yes, the state is better able to manage these assets, but maybe we are now better able to manage the state. Because we actually, just like it made us more visible by creating data sets about us, but as we create data sets about the state, maybe we make it more manageable. And I don't say that kind of in a utopian sense, in that I think, like, you know, we're going to control the state. I do actually hope that there's some positive benefits from that, that it gives us kind of a counterweight to the power of the state. But I think it also raises real questions around who's going to control that counterweight and who's going to have the ability to influence it. So when we make the state more visible and when we can control the state more effectively, who actually ends up benefiting from that? So I kind of like, and then ultimately, will the state revolt? Just like our history is filled with people who revolt, being kind of like, having a census down on them, being measured by the state, will the state itself revolt to being measured by us? And so those are the kind of, for me, some like interesting research questions that I think, or at least some interesting ideas that I hope influence some of the research questions going on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. I asked Yochai Benkler, well known for his deep thinking on the wealth of networks, and someone who I think we should all get into the open government research world. So part of this is co-opting Yochai to drag him into this frame. So Yochai, your comments here.
So Susan kindly prefaced by the fact that I'm ignorant of what goes on, but I thought before you spoke that I would be the one with the cold water, although I shouldn't have, having listened to Archon before. And I should preface by saying that a lot of what I learned from listening and reading to Archon and listening and reading Jennifer's work on her dissertation over the last few years when she was doing her doctorate. So I don't want to repeat the same cold water. I just want to identify a couple of particular points. The first one is just to repeat, there's a lot of hype and a lot of misunderstanding, and it has to be very careful. The second one, which is implicit in both of the prior presentations, but I think needs to be crystallized, you cannot understand data independent of the institutional and organizational configuration of power. So the debate about the census, it's not only Canada. We stopped collecting in our census questions, in our economic census questions about internet access when it turned out the data were showing that we had gone the wrong way in selling out to the major incumbents. So we just stopped collecting the data that would otherwise have gone to the OECD to show our decline. And then, lo and behold, you switched administrations and you start arguing about what data to collect. So, but the critical point, and this is, again, if I remember and I think about the IDRC meeting a couple of years ago here on a second decadal review of the ICT4D program, it's the question of how to focus specifically on the problems of the South. And institutional capacity to produce, structure, and distribute data is technically complex, politically sensitive, and trivially susceptible to manipulation in such a way that a naive investment in open data could be trivially. So here, let me just channel Jennifer a little bit on recovery.gov, because I can't sit at the table and hear someone say, you can't have individuals produce sophisticated data, because Joe Sixpack won't run Stata without saying, I can't sit here and not say Wikipedia, Linux, etc. That's just no longer a viable statement. To say you can't find clusters within the population that can act on decentralized models. But recovery.gov has another problem, which is the structure of the data is not amenable to actual transparency. You don't know what's behind the $1.6 million grant in this particular place. It's about getting agencies to describe in usable categories what it is that's happening. And so that's an institutional capacity at one level. And at another level, it's institutional buy-in to actually make themselves transparent. There are ways of describing the data in a way that makes them machine processable in a way that's really comparable, and there are ways of basically obfuscation. So I can say that $1.6 million was spent down the street on a contract, but I don't know what it is and what it's for. I don't think the limit, the efficient limit there is the fact that you can't find 1,000 sophisticated grad students who'd be really excited about doing this, and you need an organization. The organizations are important. I think the problem is getting governments to actually describe the data in ways that are, in fact, usable by said 1,000 grad students. And we've learned that lesson in the last decade plus from free software and on. But that has a particular lesson for investment in the Global South, because both the technical capabilities, the civil service culture, the commitment to doing it is highly variable from place to place. And I'd say if there's one thing, given that I need to make a very short statement, if there's one thing to say is to understand that there's a country-by-country, sometimes even region-by-region analysis that needs to be done about what is feasible and not in terms of open data. If, for example, the government is not particularly well-functioning, but there's a very vibrant group of techies who are engaged in free software development or statisticians, or there's a strong expat community that is going to be willing to do this, and you can use a particular kind of open data model to harness those people to work around a non-functional government, that may be a strategic intervention. More likely than not, building capacity within the government to say, what we need to do is to standardize food safety standards and put them out there on a label that's a very low-tech sort of here's what you have here or there. The ABC model is more a model of built institutional capacity within government and a good civil service structure. It is decidedly not an open, not decidedly not. I would push back on the idea that it's an open data approach. It's invest not in open data models, but in well-functioning civil service models of producing standardized reporting requirements from companies and translation, easy interface translations to users. I would not track that as an open government. I'm not sure, at least. But particularly, again, from the perspective of investment in the Global South, it's always a trade-off between investment in internal governmental institutional capacity versus finding hacks, ways where you can peel off data in a way that is relatively easy to do in a usable form, not something that can easily be dodged by the government by lumping it in all sorts of ways. So Caribou Movement is that kind of an example in the sense that it seems apolitical. You might actually get a professional who's doing this in a particular place without understanding the political implications that then creates a political flow to solve a particular problem. But I think the investment needs to be much more strategic and local. And by strategic, I actually probably mean tactical. And local and defined for the local. And always in opposition to if I put this money in open data relative to if I put this money in building internal capacity and norms for disclosure and extraction from companies. And I completely agree on the question of using the government as a counterbalance to private power. But I also think that governments are dangerous too. I put it in high, and high-low rather than at high-low. That's it.
Fantastic. I have a few words for us coming from the perspective of someone who recently served in government. I suspect that several of you have. As we look at the open government movement around the world, and I was one who was quite excited about the potential of the open government partnership, it has struck me over the last year that it has a deep potential to be the study of bright, shiny objects, at least from the developed country point of view, that looking for stories that seem to indicate that change might happen and then celebrating them out of perspective, out of proportion to what they actually accomplished. And if I were looking to devote resources to a research agenda, I would be very concerned about finding ways to visualize this complex system, which is what we're talking about. Lots and lots of input, a lot of data swirling around, institutions building capacity, feedback loops that are rich or not, emergent reactions that occur or don't. We only make progress when those things are visible. And government only responds to pressure from the outside that is so persuasive that it cannot be denied. So their own permeable membrane has to adjust. Right now, my perception is that government may be using the open data movement in some countries as a form of elite avoidance of some of the most difficult problems that their societies face. So grinding poverty, growing inequality, these are the questions that government should be confronting. And by just releasing data, we haven't solved those problems. So I would be very interested in an agenda that looked at visible policy impacts. What happens to the allocation of resources if individuals are actually able to participate in budgeting, in making strategic decisions about what priorities of government should be? What's visible about policy change? So far, I've seen very little research on that point, and it troubles me because governments will never react if they don't see real change. Second research question from my perspective is public participation in policymaking effective, or are the same five people in a smoke-filled room still making all the key decisions? It's actually possible to get slivers of attention from people about difficult policy areas because of what technology makes possible, get their attention, get their input, and have them both feel a same sense of agency, which is what we hope for from the open government movement, and a real reaction from the government inside. And a third point I'd love to see work on is, does government actually change internally in response to all of this? Because the Obama administration made a lot of claims here in America about the power of the open government movement, but then kept behind its walls its structures entirely intact, where it's still almost impossible to get anything done, and there's a lot of mid-level civil servant resistance to genuine change, an innovative culture, whatever you want to call it. So if I were king and structuring the research agenda, given all of these imponderables, Archon points out who's actually using the data, you know, David says quite rightly it's all political. My contribution here is to say, and the system only changes if research makes things visible that weren't apparent before, and that visibility creates real pressure on government to change and enrich its approach to democracy. But my real role here is to get the rest of you talking. That's because I know we're seething with thoughts. It's been, what's the most important thing that we can say right now to help structure the brains of the people who are going to be allocating these research grants? What's the most important thing? Michael?
I want to challenge, I think, what Archon and David said. I just spent almost two months in Africa, in Central Africa, working with governments, and not with donors, but with governments and with various organizations that are working with governments. And I don't recognize, from what Archon said and what David said, the reality of what I saw there. I mean, what I see is that the model of government that they're presenting is that government is either the capitalist government or it's the authoritarian government. I think there has to be an interim model, which is that government is positive, that government is a contributor to the social good, that government can be seen as a partner, as a necessary partner, as part of a broad framework of development. And I saw some very hopeful signs of that. And the issue that I see is that data is one element of that. And I really appreciate what Yokai said, because data contributes to this process. It's possible to strengthen these processes by focusing on and investing in effective means for developing data. Focusing on openness or non-openness is really almost irrelevant in those issues. It's really a question of building capacity. And if the framework is one that is effective and developing, then the issue of openness should be part of that process. And it's these are multi-stakeholder processes and should be part of those processes. And so I think that it's very, very, I think it's not appropriate to be thinking simply about government in terms of transparency, in terms of that data is only about transparency and accountability and so on. Data is also about development, also about supporting development. And I think that that's the challenge that we have here, as to how to see how open data or open data as an element of data, as an element of the building of the internal capacity to develop and manage data, is a tool of development. And so it's not a question of simply seeing, data as a basis for advocacy. It's a basis for effective planning,
right,
for program development, for evaluation, for empowering various segments of the society. And I think that has to be underlying our research, what we kind of pursue and see as our research direction. Because I think that we're opting for the world of a developed world approach to data, as opposed to, I think, what should be our direction, which is a global south approach or whatever. So, thanks.
That's fascinating. Yes, Pete.
I just want to pick up on what Mike has said, because it's relevant to my dissertation that I'm about to defend next month. I spent a few years ago in South Africa, mainly doing what Michael was describing. My interest was how government data and information is being used to tackle those development problems in South Africa, from food security to HIV/AIDS, all kinds of problems. And what happened is that in this regard, when I looked at that as a tool for development, I focus on the way that it helps them generate knowledge,
yeah,
that feeds back to the government. And this is how I demonstrated the value of this information, instead of saying, I measured the value. I couldn't measure any value. Nobody could tell me exactly what was, the value of information. But when I came across, for example, the education roadmap document that the Development Bank of Southern Africa developed, when I asked them the question, what was your use of government data, they said this was our main source. And it had all sorts of problems. But now the government is using it, actually, to go back to education plan. So this is something. The other thing is that, donors and, organizations in Africa, they have limited budgets. They need to prioritize their funding. Also, they use this data. They get the data, they clean it, they come up with decisions, and they will say, this is where we will put the $1 million. This is where what is needed. So I would like to emphasize this point. And if I look at the framework, and this was the point I wanted to add, is that if you look at, let me just see it here on my computer, or you can put it here. It's okay. It's here. Yeah. So if you look at the emerging outcomes of it, I didn't really see any mention of the value of this information and data to generate knowledge in these countries,
mm-hmm,
that can be used, actually academic and policy knowledge. This is very important. Just remember, they have a problem, like in South Africa where I was there, almost every single report that I studied, which was like 12 of them, mainly relied on this, and now it's being used in different contexts. The last thing that I would like to add is that, having lived in developing countries and worked in South Africa for some time, I would like to emphasize the historical element, of those countries. And we have to realize that in addition to all the issues that David and Artem mentioned about the U.S. or the OECD, there's an issue of, what is the concept of openness in these countries sometimes is not really clear to almost everybody there, even those who claim that they know. Openness is an attitude. Openness is like a concept in your mind that you live it. I've lived in North America for 8 years, and I do this for, living and work. But because I was born in a country where openness wasn't really that attitude, I still struggle sometimes, right? The academic ride is different from the real ride, when I think about it. So keep this in mind, and this should help us to have realistic expectations of what we can get from this research.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a point I would like to emphasize. I'll just leave the floor for others, and I'll come back with some other specific comments.
Tim?
I'll come there. So I think struck by two points. One is the framing we've got here around governance rather than governments, and recognizing, mm-hmm, particularly the role of donors, the role of all sorts of different players in different countries, from private sector, public sector, national public sector, sort of multilateral institutions. And I think this is something we've still got to wrap our heads around, is where the data is coming from all these different players, and how this is playing out in describing. I think one of the things we found hardest was describing governance situations and working out what's the literature in the world we should be tapping into there, that's really exploring how governance has shifted from a sort of government-citizen approach to recognising all these different institutions. The other thing I want to pick up on was a comment actually Michael made a few weeks ago in Helsinki about seeing data as part of a process and a service, not as a stock of stuff. And we so often treat open data as if there is this data set that is a stock of data, rather than recognising it always needs to be mobilised, put into action, and have a whole range of intermediary services around it. And I'm quite struck by the potential for us to learn from some of the open source world, where managing those ecosystems, managing and working out what's a sustainable ecosystem of development, what isn't around a piece of software asset, what can that teach us about data as well. So I work on the International Aid Transparency Initiative, where we are learning by doing and making lots of mistakes, and how do we make sure not only there's a data set over here, but there's all the tools people need to use it. How do we let the market provide those, civic hackers provide those, but how do we then fill the gaps when a civic hacker loses their job and so can't spend free time on that anymore, and suddenly that could become a key part of our ecosystem and infrastructure, and suddenly lots of downstream users are having problems and so on. So working out and trying to see this quite complex structure between the data over here and the uses over here, and then work out what sort of interventions can make it sustainable is I think another challenge in this space.
I find this a fascinating point. So you've got an ecosystem of data for many different entities, not just government, not just private citizens, but a variety of actors that are trying to move objects on the face of the earth, improve their lives. What research frameworks, in your view, people who haven't spoken down there, might help us understand the healthiness of that ecosystem better? Yes?
We came across recently somebody at Oxford who does ethnographies of policymakers. Because there's a lot of explosion of interest right now in the whole case star or knowledge management dimension. And Wendy and I did a study for IDRC on all the different aspects of knowledge management or research communications. And one of the difficult things is understanding the demand side, when the demand side cannot articulate it very clearly because it's a moving target. So we've come across an enormous amount of information or knowledge about, or this, there was just a conference in Hamilton, in Ontario, called Case Star, Knowledge Management, Knowledge Translation. So the entry point relative to this group was not data, but knowledge, which speaks to your point. So I think if there's a lot of ongoing work in fields that are very directly connected to data.
Knowledge management as a... in fact, I suspect there are fields all over academia that connect to this. You get this hallucinatory sense that everything connects after a while. Yes.
Just a small thing, and it's really more a question of how you want to frame your own decisions within the range of grant making. And this really responds directly, I think, to Michael and Ryan's interventions. The idea of knowledge for development, the idea of building capacity for self-measurement for purposes of development, is not a new one. It's something that people have been talking about for a long time. Clearly, there's something about the use of open data that is creating a mismatch between, not clearly. At least from this little exchange, it suggests that there's a potential mismatch between what we initially start to talk about when we trigger open data and open government, and the core urgent needs of development. So question one is, it's too much work to deal with open government. Let's focus on what we always knew, knowledge for development, data collection for purposes of government planning, etc. That's where the cash value is. The other option is to say, okay, we know that's important. Are there discrete ways of improving those functionings, including feeding back to the role of corruption in failures of development, that could leverage some of these materials? But then it almost needs a different name. Maybe it's open data for development, maybe it's data for development, maybe something that anchors it in We're only interested in this small slice of what you guys are worried about over there, where you have billions of dollars to invest in this, and where development in many senses takes care of itself. Tell that to Greece. So I just don't know what the amount of grant making and whether you really want to focus specifically on what aspects of this very complex and diverse set of things people are working on under the umbrella of open data could contribute to what we already know for a long time, which is knowledge for development is a really important form of investment, which would be my intuition.
Yes.
Susan, did that relate what he just said to your point, and I've been mulling it over, when you said you worry a little bit about focus on open data is taking away from some of the other issues of power and inequality and so on?
Yeah, my great dream is to join these two conversations. So what Michael and Ray are talking about is exactly what I think is important. But Yochai is adding on here that there's a benefit to bringing in this new work on open government and governance and contributing it to existing work in the developing world that's been going on for a long time. So it's a way of...
And there's actually an ironic translation because some of the civic hacking that's really about applications, when we look at it from the perspective of transparency, seems like a critique. Yes, we say transparency and accountability and really we're talking about catch the bus. But it's entirely possible that from a development perspective, that's what you want first of all, that people know there are buses and where they can catch them. And you'll deal with transparency 20 years from now. And the thing that's a critique here may be exactly the thing you're trying to harness there.
That's very true. So I have had the feeling in America that we're focusing on some bright, shiny objects and that this deeper agenda is not really being undertaken. If we can join these two worlds, I think there's a lot we can get done. But yes, Rob.
I think this conversation is moving in an important direction in talking about ecosystems and the evolution of ecosystems. And I think if we're talking about development, poverty, alleviation, a lot of this work is improving the work of institutions and societies. And I'd like to kind of point for a little bit of common ground between Archon and Yochai, which I think Archon makes a very, very important point that it is organizations that are going to be consumers of this organ, of this information. And one of the things that I think would be important to look for is how open data might actually contribute to the strengthening or even the formation of civil society organizations. Mm-hmm. And I think Yochai's work is also very, very important in this manner, which is that there are new ways of forming organizations, and that's not necessarily in the traditional ways that
right.
we saw, but that there are new ways to form digital organizations.
David has had his hand up.
Yeah, come on. I actually don't feel like, I'm not sure what I said that makes you feel like it was in disagreement with anything that you added. I definitely think that Archon might have said some things. and this kind of brings me to one of the challenges I'm feeling around open data right now is that I think open data at the moment is making everybody unhappy because it's not sufficiently meeting any one stakeholder's goals. And it's getting appropriated for all sorts of things. So some
right.
people want to use open data for development. Other people want to use open data for transparency. Other people want to use open data to hold governments to account. Other people want to use open data for economic development. And I think that actually it has something to do with all of those things. And I don't think it's the pixie dust that's going to make any one of those things
right.
magically happen. And so we kind of, now people kind of say, well, open data is not going to solve all the transparency problems. They're like, yes, it absolutely isn't. And then it kind of the open data gets critiqued about that and that alone. And then someone says, well, you know, it could be useful in development. I'm like, yes, it could be useful in development, but yes, I also agree it's not going to solve everything there either. The one place where I actually think that open data is potentially the most useful, and I hope gets into a research agenda somewhere, and I only reviewed 7 of the projects, so I didn't see it in any of the ones that I looked at, but... I'm most excited about how open data can change government.
Yeah.
That, when I've talked to most of the people who operate open data portals, some of you have heard me talk about this before, but that kind of the reoccurring theme tends to be that about 30% of the visitors to an open data portal come from IP addresses within the government that created that open data portal. And that suggests to me that maybe that open data is actually enabling the government, like that, the poor innovators who are inside government, who are desperately trying to get data so they can write the policy that will try to solve a problem, are finally actually able to access data that their own institution is creating, but they each have to get five other managers to sign off on before they have access to. So for kind of breaking down those transaction costs, that's actually, I think, that for me is like one obvious area where I'm hoping that open data has some very interesting things to play. And I'd like to think that it's going to help on the development front, because if you architect for open in that way, it might make it easier for kind of governments to find ways to do development more, much more cheaply than I think we in the West are kind of currently creating public policy.
Yes, Jennifer.
So I'd like to make 2 points. One, I think it can be important to make better connections between open data and open government or openness in general, because there are other forms of openness in government than data, and technology can be used for textual analysis, which reveals even more interesting trends than data itself. So this focus on machine-readable data is very understandable because it's easier to get it and it's clear what we are looking at. But other forms of government decision-making, budget allocations, even newspaper analysis can actually create a much richer picture and inform this general open government ecosystem. And then talking about ecosystems, as more and more players, and it's specifically relevant for development, but as more and more actors release their data, it becomes increasingly important to see how budgets flow. So for instance, an institution like the World Bank, they release their data, and then a country like Tanzania releases their data, and then we can see to what extent the data from the World Bank, which is Tanzania, and what happens down the road. So to make these connections, here's the place where open data can be really important to understand what works and what doesn't work in development, because we can see this flow from an international institution to the street level in a city. And as part of it should be very important to measure changes in impact over time, which currently doesn't really happen because usually data is released as one-time thing, and then it's not necessarily being updated. So if we are looking at impact, that seems to be quite important.
I want to pick up on David and Jennifer's last interventions here. As we're looking for change over time in governance affected by open government, open data, what are our suggestions for evaluators of projects about how that could be measured? Is it possible to measure? Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, it always concerns me after having done extensive research about value, information, and knowledge, and et cetera, to use measure. Because it's very difficult. You know, you have network effects. You have other things.
It's a complex system.
Yeah, it's very complex. And even when I was reviewing my proposals, I was thinking only about a way that if this project to be successful in the future, we have to have a system that, as General said, that over time, we have those, let's say, indicators or signs that tell us that they are on the right track. I don't want to judge success or failure at this stage. I would like to see improvement in the team. I would like to see the community center in this village is using some of this information, whether it was used efficiently or effectively, to raise $10,000 or not. It's not my concern at this point.
Right.
Is it getting into the community? Is our understanding about open data increasing? And how do we know that? We have to be more, I would say, qualitative in this and give time to this to emerge.
Terrific. I see Tim.
Very big point. I think the other thing we've got to find ways of tracking is unintended consequences and the things that we're not looking for, and that makes them really hard to find.
Yeah.
But I think really important to be looking at as well.
Somebody hasn't. Yes.
Yeah, just to pick up on a couple of things that have been said, and I start with the point Michael made that governments are not inherently bad things or good things. I mean, for the most part, they're positive and they're intendedly good. They're just not very efficient.
Yeah.
And most of the times, they can't figure out how to get stuff done.
Yeah.
And sort of from our perspective, and in that regard, I see open data as a vehicle for engagement. It starts a whole bunch of conversations between government and people that have been non-traditional participants in governance, developers and universities who traditionally contributed to policy in a different kind of way, but now they are directly engaged.
Yeah.
So I like to think of open data. I mean, we're having many hats of open data here, but it really is a disruptor.
Mm.
I think it changes the way that the conversations take place, and it means that it's hard to predict those unintended consequences that Tim said.
Right.
You almost can't say what will come out at the end of this. But it drives a level of engagement between a set of constituents that traditionally have been very detached from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing that's fascinating about it, that it's really how do we harness that towards many of these positive outcomes that we're really needing.
It's very interesting. Michael, I saw you had your hand up.
I just want to add, I think, to what Maurice said and what you're talking about. That is, I think, from a research perspective, we should be looking at the strategic level as well.
Yeah.
What are the different strategies? The models of open data use in various environments, what are the effects of that?
That
I think is be a very useful research activity to see various jurisdictions will be using data and knowledge, open data in various kinds of ways, and then to assess those in terms of the impact and see which are better, which aren't. One of the interesting things for me I just did was the way in which the process of reflecting on, in part, on the data was in fact acting in a very positive way to enhance the capacity of the people who were doing it, because there was a peer effects going on. You were being challenged to think about additional areas that they hadn't thought about before. So this was in fact acting in a positive way to do capacity building in the various institutions. And that wasn't an effect that anyone was expecting. And but I think strategically, if you start looking at the various strategies and different models, then you can kind of identify ways in which appropriate ways of proceeding, or better ways of proceeding than others.
Which picks up deeply on Tim's point that looking at a very local level and qualitatively, and looking at things as a system and attempting to describe it and then have other people comment on it, maybe that's the best we can do in working in such a system. Yes, Arkham.
On that, I don't think it's the best you can do. I think everyone in the looking at the impact ought to hold themselves to a higher standard in at least sketching out what you think the full chain of causation from the provision of the information to some consequence of that information is, right? And so, you know, think about my funnel. So where I think you suggested is enough is describing the openness of the data and the participation in the use of that data, right? But that never gets you to the third circle. Whether the third circle for you is accountability or economic development or human development or learning, I don't care. But that third circle is really, really important. And understanding means understanding, you know, not only that first arrow, causal arrow, about what causes participation and engagement or not, but the second arrow as well about, well, when does that participation and engagement actually do something good in addition to the intrinsic value of participation and engagement, right? And I think the drop-off, as I said, is very steep. A second point on the research dimension, it's always helped me to think about paired cases, to think about more than one, and in particular to think about a loser and a winner, because that imposes a discipline in your own head about, well, what is a loser, right? If you think, well, everything's a winner, then I don't think you're asking yourself hard enough questions. What is the loser? What is the winner? And then that creates some variation so that you can begin to understand, well, what's causing this thing to lose and this one to win, right? That's first. The second comment is, I take the point about development, and I think I agree with Yochai's response. Open data is a means to a chain of ends, and I think it would be a mistake to fetishize open data and put all of our energy in that. I think it's important to be clear about what your bigger project is, right? And if it's increasing the capacity of the state, open government is a means to that, and some configurations of open government will do that and some will not. If it's about accountability and transparency as an instrument to development, because you know that 60% of the school teachers in Tanzania just don't show up every day, and so maybe that particular state is not so well-intended, not just an efficiency problem, but a corruption problem, then a certain kind of open data will do that, right? If your project is data to provide private sector actors with additional means to produce more economic value, then certain open data strategies will do that. But you know, I think it's important to think about the whole chain and your end at, in addition to the means of just open data, because they're so related.
Okay. Yeah, I think just adding to what Arvin was saying, many of the research starts exactly in the bigger circle of your funnel. I think one way to go would be to focus on the smaller circle of the funnel as a starting point. And I understand from all the comments is that open data is kind of passing the buck from other issues that we really should be focusing on. And perhaps doing open data research, we should bring those back as a core, as a center, as a starter, and broaden up basically our concerns, not only think about open data for freedom of expression, but open data as a role playing with censorship, or instead of just transparency about secrecy, or instead of just about accountability, what's the role of power concentration, and how open data plays out in that, participation, beta players, and so on. Basically, just turn aside and focus on the smaller funnel, and opening the window to these other issues we have been passing the buck on as a starting point for the research.
Last word, Fernando.
Oh, just a comment, I guess. There are two things. I guess one of the things that I find less useful over time is the distinction between supply and demand in terms of data, because it's really about it's an ecosystem that creates data and is much more diverse, as you have just said, there's kind of could come from everywhere, basically, and there are different collective ways to generate this data that might, that we usually see this in the developed country that won't be the same in the developing country. So there's an ecosystem that generates the data more and more internationally. It's not just about one government generating a specific data set. And there are standards that are emerging, pushes that are kind of a technical ecosystem around generating data on a specific domain. So I guess there, this is one of things that I found it less useful, but I'm just looking for things. There's a huge demand inside government for data that comes from outside, so it just doesn't make a lot of sense to just about the money supply. It's about the ecosystem. But as this ecosystem develops, how this gets into the local governance, the process of decision making, and the process, that's what we try to distinguish between the kind of the open data and all this environment of things that generate data versus the local context, the budgeting and the local level, how the decision is taking place, who is using the data, as I said, just kind of, that this has an interaction or not, so that this might be good or might be bad, and this might be creating different anomalies in terms of power distribution or empowering different groups, and so on. That's the kind of question I think that you were kind of trying to get to. And this kind of leads into some emerging outcomes that are positive or bad, and really, I guess, maybe just so. And I agree with you that this kind of somehow connects with your cycle. I don't know. A lot of data has been started being generated. There's a bit of, I just seen a bit of a connection with what you propose and some of the issues that we're kind of trying to look at. Mm-hmm. See the process of participation or engagement and use of that data and what's kind of really making in terms of impact at the end of the day. Just trying to connect some of the things that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. If this, with these nuances, the population will survive the violence.
Okay, it's impossible to sum up this conversation. So I will say it's been extremely interesting, and I think does set a number of markers for the discussion for the rest of the day, and I wish you a good conversation and a rich one. Thank you very much.